Welcome to the Research Impact podcast series. I'm your host, Richard Cotterill, and I'm joined by Dr. Elaine Kinsella, lecturer in the Department of Psychology at the University of Limerick and winner of the President's Research Excellence and Impact Early Career Researcher Awards 2022, and also Dr. Rachel Sumner, Senior Research Fellow at Cardiff Metropolitan University. Thanks very much for joining me today, Elaine and Rachel. If I could start with you, Elaine, could you give me a little insight into the project that you carried out and the participants that you targeted?
Thanks, Richard. So the CV19 Heroes project was set up in March 2020 to track the well-being of frontline workers in the UK and Ireland through surveys and through interviews during the pandemic. And we felt that time was of the essence, so we've worked really quickly to create a baseline survey and to build a social media following and to recruit participants in both countries. And from the start, we felt it was really important to assess the psychological impact of working on the frontline across all sectors, not limited to healthcare. We wanted to really get the full spectrum of views and hear the stories of frontline workers directly from them in their own words via the interviews. Also, in Ireland and the UK, both countries adopted very different public health strategies, particularly at the start of the pandemic. So we wanted to assess how these differences would play out in terms of frontline workers' psychological health, and also what key learnings we could draw in terms of how better to support frontline workers and also how to manage future crises better in the future. And Rachel and I both have quite different but complementary skills and expertise that relate to health, well-being and also into organisations. So we knew that we could use our knowledge and expertise to do something useful during the pandemic. So in terms of a timeframe, we ran the baseline survey from March to May 2020. And then we did one-to-one interviews from June to July 2020. And we completed a six-month follow-up survey in October 2020, and then a 12-month follow-up survey in March 2021.
Thanks, Elaine. And Rachel, if I can turn to you now, can you tell me a little bit about the key survey findings from the project?
Sure, thank you. So, we've got a lot of findings so far. There's still much more for us to actually produce from the data that we've collected. And obviously, we're still collecting data going forward as well. But what we found so far is certainly from our original survey back last year that frontliners are, unsurprisingly, not doing too great. Interestingly, we found that actually those that were in the UK seem to be suffering more compared to those in Ireland. They tended to have lower resilience, lower well-being, and higher levels of burnout as well. We also found, perhaps less surprisingly to me, that frontline workers in the UK rated their government's response to the crisis significantly poorer than those who are based in Ireland. We asked them in terms of the perception of the government's timeliness, effectiveness, and appropriateness of their response. And actually, for each of those, the UK-based workers tended to rate their government as being far lower than those in Ireland. After the first surge, there's some uncertainty, certainly in the frontline workers in Ireland, about testing and diagnosis for COVID. And this tended to be linked to the poorer well-being and burnout that we were able to evidence from that side of the cohort. Frontline healthcare workers' burnout has a very strong pattern around exhaustion, which is not entirely surprising considering the type of work that they're doing, the fact it's been very relentless, the fact that they are, seeing patient after patient come through the door, and also those in supermarkets and other areas of work, the speed of their work has been stepped up exponentially. Feelings of cynicism and inadequacy have also increased over time, and those two are also really important components of burnout. Burnout is a very complex pattern of occupational stress that involves a variety of different factors, but eventually can be absolutely catastrophic for a worker. So it's a really key sort of outcome in terms of critical work to understand, but also to try and prevent in the future. In our frontline workers in the Republic of Ireland, general burnout, as well as each of those dimensions, has actually remained relatively stable. In terms of some of the other things that we've looked at our six-month points, that was October last year, as Elaine said, we had almost 83% of the healthcare workers in the UK having some sort of recognisable PTSD, which is a colossal amount. This compared to 73% of those based in Ireland. In the 12-month survey and interviews, we've got a variety of different things coming through. We haven't fully analysed the data for those just yet, but I can let you know some sort of overall findings from that. So the perception of the government response in terms of that appropriate, timely, effective has gone down in all of our workers compared to baseline. And, the baseline certainly for the UK workers wasn't great to start with, but actually a lot of this change has been carried by those in Ireland. So to begin with, the frontline workers in Ireland As I said before, they rated their government response significantly better than those based in the UK, but this seems to have decreased over time. There are various factors associated with those different dimensions of government response that have changed in the UK. So the rating of appropriate has gone down consistently, both at 6 months and 12 months. Effective has gone down at both 6 months and 12 months. But timely has remained consistently low, which I think is a, you know, recurring pattern, unfortunately, for the UK. So, you know, this has sort of led us to conclude that, you know, changing strategy, particularly in those in Ireland, seems to have had some sort of impact on the overall perception of the workers, which is really important because, you know, they obviously need to have some confidence that the crisis is being managed. In the Republic of Ireland, virtually all points of comparison in each of those domains were having a downward trajectory, showing an overall sort of weakening in confidence with regard to the government's perception of their handling of the crisis. We've had some free text input, which has talked about anything that participants feel like they want to show, the muddling of messages, the particular impact in Ireland of the meaningful Christmas and how that's caused such a huge wave for them to deal with. And this has obviously led to Ireland at that particular point, having previously been one of the EU's lowest proportional COVID infection rate countries, to now being one of the worst in the world. Wellbeing has continued to take a hit, sadly. It was lower than population norms in those in the UK, and it's definitely declining. It's also declining in those in the Republic of Ireland who actually back this time last year seem to be doing comparatively better. Levels of burnout are climbing higher, as I'm sure can be expected. So I'll just pass over to Elaine now, who's going to talk to us about the interview findings.
Thanks, Rachel. So the findings from the interviews helped to add more depth and detail to the survey findings. So there were clear themes across all of the 38 interviews conducted across all sectors of frontline workers in the UK and Ireland after the first surge. We found that there were some common experiences across all of these frontline workers, despite the differences across sectors and different organisational cultures and so on. So, for example, many of the frontline workers described their intense anticipation of the first surge. There was a very strong sense of uncertainty and foreboding. Some actually likened this to being called up for war and waiting for the battle to start and not knowing what horrors awaited them. Most frontline workers described how every single aspect of their work and their home life changed dramatically, almost overnight, with many people having to change the way they worked in significant ways, often with limited support. One participant described the first surge as pure hell. There were also many reports of working long hours, understaffing, confusion, and limited support. Many participants noted that they needed more support at work. One participant described in detail the impacts of their experience on absolutely every part of their lives. Participants described themselves as becoming more withdrawn, disengaged, jaded, and a number of them described how their usual ways of recharging their batteries no longer worked. There were also mixed reports about the availability of PPE and COVID testing across frontline workers in the UK and Ireland. And what's important here is that the extent to which these were or were not available impacted on their feelings of safety, support, and their ability to cope. Overall, frontline workers described the huge psychological and emotional toll that working through the pandemic had had on them. During the first surge, many frontline workers were working in teams with many colleagues off sick, and they felt that they really had to keep going because there just wasn't anybody else to cover for them. Also, the media was highlighted as potentially making things worse for frontline workers. Many participants reported having to just reduce their media consumption and their news consumption to avoid becoming more ill and more agitated. But I think it's important also to highlight that there were some positive aspects. Some frontline workers felt that they were receiving greater recognition and appreciation. They felt that others were actually noticing their important work and their contribution, perhaps for the first time. And there are some early signs in the data that people were finding silver linings and showing hope for the future. And as we know, many of the frontline workers were declared as heroes during the pandemic. And heroes are known for their strength, their resilience, their fearlessness, their bravery, and their willing to sacrifice and protect other people. And for many, the use of this hero label was quite positive at the beginning, and it was quite encouraging. It was a source of recognition for all their efforts. But for some frontline workers, this over time began to feel like pressure to live up to the expectations of the label. So they felt they actually had to keep going no matter what, because they had been labeled as a hero. And one person actually told us, "I don't want to be a hero anymore. I don't want to be. I'm all worried out." The clap for the heroes was also perceived as good, particularly at the start of the pandemic, as a way of signalling support. But actually, it became quite damaging over time when set up against a backdrop of perceived insufficient government and public support. It soon became some sort of an unpleasant reminder that actually these frontline workers don't have much choice in having to go to work. And in some cases, this was viewed as a way of sidestepping more meaningful compensation, such as an appropriate pay review. And one particularly upsetting aspect for frontline workers was this perceived incongruence between people using the hero label and their own behaviour. So on one hand, calling frontline workers heroes, but on the other hand, not engaging or abiding by public health advice. So this was described as a kick in the teeth by some frontline workers.
That's great. Thanks for that, Helene. Yeah, I think it's clear from that, like, the huge impact that the pandemic had on the lives of and the lives and the attitudes of the frontline workers. Generally, I suppose we tend to associate frontline workers with emergency services and healthcare workers. Yet, many people in other professions found themselves unwittingly in the front line of this pandemic. Why was it important to you to include these people in particular in your project?
Yeah, we did feel this was really important. Other research has focused exclusively on healthcare workers. In fact, in previous research during previous crises, there's been no mention of frontline workers outside of healthcare settings. So from the start, we could see that the impact was broader than only in healthcare settings. I suppose we felt a real sense of compassion for those people working on the front line across all sectors. And we could see that it really was a serious situation for everyone involved. And we wanted to assess this impact through our research in the CB19 Heroes project. We also discussed quite a lot at the start how many healthcare workers and members of the Defence Forces are often trained somewhat, at least, for emergencies and disasters, whereas frontline workers in retail, supply chain, logistics probably haven't been prepared and probably never imagined themselves working in such difficult situations. So in our view, there were some key challenges that were common across all the sectors. So obviously there was risk of exposure to the disease, there was long hours, uncertainty, but there were also other factors that were unique to each of the particular settings. So for example, supermarket workers had to deal with hoarding behaviour, along with, in some cases, abuse from the general public. So we wanted to capture some of those broader challenges, but also some of those more specific challenges. And we really wanted to hear from those frontline workers who often slip under the radar. So the cleaners, the drivers, the carers, who maybe don't receive the full recognition that they deserve, but they are experiencing significant impacts of working through the pandemic and at often a great cost.
And subsequently, you were both invited to present your findings to an all-party parliamentary group from the UK Parliament. What was their reaction to your findings?
So the All-Party Parliamentary Group, or the APPG, is an informal cross-party group run by and for members of the Commons and Lords in the UK. So we were invited to comment on healthcare workers specifically in the UK and their experiences of the pandemic, and also to present our key findings from the project and our recommendation. So the committee that we presented to was made up of British parliamentarians and also peers. The findings were really well received. They particularly appreciated hearing the experience of frontline workers in their own words. So we used direct quotes where possible. So this really reiterated the importance to us of using interview and free text response methods to capture frontline workers' experiences in their own words in a really authentic way. So this type of approach of our methods really complemented the survey methods that we used, providing us with the depth and the detail and the nuances, as well as the breadth of information. So the APPG have asked us to keep in touch with new findings over time. So that's really great news for us. So our work has also received significant interest in the mainstream media, and our findings have been included in the Post. So that's the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology in their policy report to the UK government.
Yeah, I think that's a great example of the impact that your research has had thus far. If I could ask you, Rachel, how have you tried to ensure that your research had this level of impact from the start of the project, from the inception of your project?
Well, I mean, I think any research about COVID is always going to have inherently, it's going to have impact behind it because it's such a, you know, it's a situation like we've never seen in our lifetime. However, for us, it was quite complicated, actually, because, I mean, there's always the approach that, you know, trying to do research on your own is hard in terms of time and in terms of money and resources. It is hard. But then time was of the essence. We could have applied for a big grant, which would undoubtedly have provided us with infinite more resources and ability and time, perhaps as well, to be able to collect the data. But that meant we would have missed out on a really important part of the story, which was from the very early days, well, March last year. And had we not got that, we wouldn't have been able to witness the changes that we've seen over time. So actually, I guess for one, it was our sort of getting stuck in and getting done. And you know, like I say, that's a difficult decision to come to in terms of trying to do justice to the work and do justice to the findings. But I think I think it's paid off in the long run in terms of us being able to really make a record of what we found. We were also really keen to make sure that we tried to embed various types of methodologies throughout our research to ensure that we, again, as Elaine said, get that balance of breadth and depth, that we have the sort of broader applicability of our findings, but we can also really dive into people's experiences and understand them. When you're trying to incorporate a huge amount of different types of occupational contexts that face different struggles, that face different issues, it's really important to get that depth as well to understand where the similarities, but also where the differences might lie. We've also been tracking the participants longitudinally. So we've been tracking them for over a year now. Neither of us are particularly sure when we might finish that. We don't see that finishing anytime soon. I guess it depends on what happens with the pandemic. And this really allows us to understand not just these sort of trajectory changes and the undulations that we might see in the various aspects that we're looking at, but also to assess causality as well. So we can actually track this right back to the beginning and say, you know, what's been causing these changes that we've observed, or what's been causing the impact in terms of burnout or PTSD or whatever it is that we're looking at. It has applicability sectors, as Elaine said, other research that's been done in terms of frontline working in times of crisis. So if you look at the first SARS outbreak, Ebola, swine flu, they've all looked at healthcare workers who are absolutely a hugely important population to look at. But we've also seen, you know, some really difficult challenges from lots of different sectors as well, particularly supermarket workers, those in care homes. They've had to make moral choices, which have been really difficult for them. They've had to face challenges they've never been trained for before. All of this was really important to ensure that we end up getting as maximal impact out of the findings that we can. In terms of sort of more strategic sides of things, we've tried to engage with journalists where we can. Our press office have been really helpful in terms of helping us to churn out timely press releases to sort of notable outlets to help get our findings out there. We've also actively engaged with parliamentary processes, so the post review that Elaine mentioned before and the APPG. We've also done our best to try to ensure that we keep our participants updated as well. I think there's been something quite, which I've never seen before in any research I've done before, but there's a lot of camaraderie within our study, and we get a lot of excellent feedback from our participants, and they're all cheering us on as much as we're cheering them on, which is really lovely to see. So, and we've tried to sort of keep that engagement by giving them regular newsletters, doing blog posts, updating the website, our various types of social media as well. So we've basically done as much as we can in the very limited time that we've had to try to ensure that we're reaching all of the levels of people that need this information as much as possible. We've also done our best to publish in open access journals as well to make sure that, you know, the findings get out there as soon as they can and as widely as they can. And I've also presented it whenever possible in free to attend conferences as well.
Yeah, I think you alluded to it there that I suppose with the pandemic, time is of the essence, and the pandemic has led to an acceleration of certain services like testing centres and vaccine development and delivery. If I can ask you, Elaine, have you found that the time span from initial research to impact has been similarly shortened in this study?
Oh, it's a really good question. So as Rachel said, we focus very much on getting started quickly to capture the data as early in the pandemic as possible. We really didn't want to miss any opportunities to gather data during those early days. So it was very much a case of all hands on deck with just the two of us running the project. So that led to quite an acceleration, I suppose, of getting things started. And we did benefit from an expedited ethical review at both of our institutions, which really did help us to start collecting that data really quickly. However, overall, I'd say we experience the same rigorous peer review at our chosen journals, and there's been no rapid acceleration of the research or publishing process. In fact, I think there's actually been more delays than usual due to many of us experiencing new challenges with childcare and homeschooling. And this includes us as researchers, but also the editors of journals and the reviewers of our articles. We've also been really strict on only releasing peer review findings once published. So this has caused tensions because other people are releasing preprints before peer review. And we've really aimed to stay clear and focused on quality throughout the project, while also striving to make our findings available as needed so that they can have an impact on policy and government and organisational decision making. But this is quite a difficult balance to achieve between making sure that our findings are accessible, but only after peer review. But once published, we have found a great deal of interest in our findings, obviously, because it's so topical, and also because of our multi-method approach. The data is extremely thorough and detailed. So it is getting picked up by the media and through Parliament briefings, which is fantastic.
And moving on from that, what are the key lessons that governments, employers, and even the public in general can learn from the impact of this pandemic for a start, and also from the findings of your study?
So our research has shown that frontline workers' experiences are broader than their immediate situation. So in fact, we can see patterns of how government response and public behaviour and also organisational response actually link to individual worker well-being. And in both nations, the timeliness of government decisions can be protective of burnout for frontline workers. So a key recommendation is for governments to take prompt and decisive action, and also to be very clear and consistent in their messaging. There's also a need to ensure that the guidance is followed by all, particularly in leadership and also in the public domain. So where people in leadership break the public health guidance or the media report on public breaches of public health guidance, this waters down the message, it shakes confidence, it breaks trust, and it reduces solidarity. So we found that adopting a resilient coping style can support resilience and well-being. It is possible to help frontline workers to develop a more resilient coping style through training and workshops at work. So this is important for employers to note. However, this is something that we would only recommend where there are short-term stressors, as over time, resilient coping in response to an ongoing or long-term threat can actually lead to burnout. Bringing COVID home has been a big worry for frontline workers, either being separated from their families or worrying about their family members. This really speaks to greater availability of testing and also increased staffing to cover illnesses, absences, and also just to enable frontline workers to take a break. There's also a need to develop protocols for being prepared for possible future disasters. So this would include plans for PPE, equipment, and guidance across all sectors. So from our data, there's a really strong sense that many staff were left to their own devices. They were left to sort things out at their own local level, especially during those very early days of the pandemic. So there's a real need to mitigate these levels of uncertainty and chaos in the future.
In terms of the public, this is a bit complicated. It's very difficult for the public to understand how they can help frontline workers. As humans, we're just uniquely driven to wanting to do something. Like Elaine and I really needed to do this research. It felt like we were doing something, we were helping, we were contributing. There was something we could put our efforts into that was helping. But actually what we've really needed broadly in the public in the pandemic is to do nothing. People need to stay home. People need to not go out. People need to not do the things that they want to do, to do the harder thing, to actually stay at home. And that's a tremendously difficult thing for people to do. And I suppose what our frontline workers have really struggled with is where, you know, because they know that people staying home is the best thing to do. They know that it means it will minimize the infection rate. And if it minimizes the infection rate, then particularly for healthcare workers, it means less people coming through the door. It means less death. And it means the chances of the pandemic finishing sooner will be much higher. Unfortunately, what they've seen instead is a lot of particular instances in the news media, but also on social media, of people not doing that, either gathering or particularly some very notable infractions of public health policy, particularly in my country. And this has been a real challenge for them. It's been, and I completely get why. It's frustrating and it's painful knowing that actually there's one thing that people can do, but for some reason they're not. Now, that's not the case because we know that the data are there in terms of people staying home. People have largely stayed at home. But the one problem is that frontline workers have seen it on TV. They've seen it on their phones, on every social media channel that they follow. So there is something about trying to ensure a consistent message. If you're staying at home, please, please, please stop sharing information about when people haven't been, even if you're shocked about it, even if you're disgusted about it. This catches on. It doesn't matter your motivation behind sharing this information. It was much like when the hoarding was happening in the supermarkets. You know, photos going around of empty shelves just meant more people stocked up and it meant the crisis continued. So have that solidarity, have that united front in terms of trying to beat this. Perhaps a reduction of token gestures as well. So make sure that the message is consistent. And this is sort of the public and the legislature. This is everybody, really. If you're going to be calling people heroes, then for want of a better term, act like you think that they're heroes. You know, give them the support that they need. Unfortunately, the hero label itself has been a really difficult thing for many frontline workers, particularly healthcare workers, to swallow because there's a lot in there that we can't go into today, but it's very difficult for somebody to accept a hero label anyway. But for those in frontline working, you know, it's what they're employed to do. It's what they've trained to do. It's not a special calling. It's not a special aspect of them as individuals. It is their job. And actually, that hero label can also be really complicated for them because it means that they are less able, well, they feel less able to fail. It means they're less able to fall apart. And they're less able to sort of deal with the feelings that they've got because they feel that need to be that hero person. And actually what frontline workers really need is to be able to fall apart from time to time. They really need to acknowledge their feelings and move forward. So we need to have some sort of alignment between actions and words. If we're going to display our appreciation for our frontline workers, we need to act like we appreciate their work as well. And this might really help. And that's not just, you know, every individual, but it's also about what you share on social media as well. This perception of solidarity seems to be really, really important in terms of our frontline workers' ability to deal with the challenges of the pandemic as they continue. And that's something we're going to be looking into in the future as well. But essentially, we all have a part to play, even if it's not doing things.
That's great. Thanks, Rachel. I think the whole feeling about living through the pandemic is that we're living through a history, living through particular points in history. If I can just move then towards the future, maybe Rachel, you might tell me, what are the future plans in terms of developing this research?
Well, I don't know. When I was thinking back to when we first started this, I'm not sure we actually still envisaged being, you know, as sort of in it as we are now, both pandemic and the research as well. I guess, you know, as long as neither of us get exhausted, we'll continue it and see it through for as long as it's needed. You know, we're still very much in the pandemic, but there's also the post-pandemic phase as well. And, you know, the struggles and the difficulties and the emotions that have arisen from the pandemic for frontline workers won't finish when the pandemic is over, whenever that might be. It will continue for a long time. We've had frontline workers talking about leaving their roles, potentially being, as Elaine said before, being jaded and disillusioned about the work that they do. This is going to have a ripple effect for a very long time. And as long as we both have the energy to do it, we're going to do our best to capture that, to understand more about it and make sure that there's learning as much as possible. So we've included some new measures recently as well, so that broader social context of solidarity that I was discussing before, to understand whether or not these types of concepts are really important in predicting burnout, but also potentially bounce back in the future as well once we get into the post-pandemic phase, whenever that may be. We've also started looking at physical health as well as mental health. Obviously, physical health, mental health, very much two sides of the same coin, and they can affect each other, you know, in a variety of different ways. So we're trying to assess whether or not this is having a longer lasting physical impact as well. We're also exploring a variety of other areas in the future, potentially the use of biomarkers, for example, and we've just applied for some funding for that to see if we can expand the research beyond. But there's also relevance of the findings beyond the pandemic as well. So when we do eventually stop collecting data on this particular project, we also know that actually there's the things that we've uncovered, particularly this element of solidarity, will likely have some definite implications for other types of occupational contexts, particularly occupational contexts where there is an interdependence. So where a worker relies on not just the people they work with or their managers or their organization, but also members of the public, whether that's their clients or patients or what have you, or even, you know, the broader element of the public as well. There are a variety of different occupational contexts where that will likely to be important. So we're going to be looking at that in the future. And in fact, we have a PhD student who's recently started with both of us, who is going to be looking into that sort of broader applicability of this new aspect of burnout as we go forward. I'm also going to be presenting something at the Cheltenham Science Festival in a few weeks, which is a public talk, which is going to be free. It's going to be broadcast on Facebook, so it's free for everyone to attend, which is going to be talking more about those public aspects that I was talking about before in terms of what we as members of the public can do to help. So for now, we're still very much within the project. We don't really know when it's going to finish, but we have possibly every 6 months we'll be doing follow-up surveys, potentially some more interviews. In fact, we've just finished a round of interviews now, potentially more interviews in the future. So we will be sticking with the project for as long as it needs to. And we're obviously engaging with our participants in terms of their feedback on that as well. But for now, we have this project and potential spin-offs to go forward to as well. So a lot of work to come.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting for the future. Thanks, Rachel. Well, just to finish up, could you tell me just a little bit about your research backgrounds and how you ended up collaborating on this particular project together?
So Rachel and I met at the University of Limerick, so at UL. We both shared an office as postdocs. So obviously we got on quite well and we've stayed in touch since. And I think we have quite complementary areas of expertise and knowledge. So Rachel is very much an expert as a psychobiologist and as a psychologist. She's also a chartered psychologist. So she has done lots of really, really interesting work looking at stress hormones and how the environmental context influences health and well-being. So that has been really added to this project, and it will certainly add to our future plans for the future, particularly as we look at the health and well-being over time of our frontline workers.
And from my perspective, I will just say that I've always been a very big fan of Elaine's work. She's, you know, as I'm sure everybody knows, an international expert in heroism, which is just a tremendously fascinating field. And I think it was when I first heard somebody referring to frontliners as heroes, I was like, I know who I need to speak to. And it sort of snowballed from there. But she's been absolutely wonderful to work with, as I always knew she would. And in fact, I've been waiting for an opportunity for several years now to work with her on a project. And this has just been, it's been amazing.
Yeah, it has been absolutely amazing. I think we work really, really well together. And I think it's hard to sustain the energy and commitment that we have had over the last year, particularly in the thick of a pandemic. So I think we've kept each other going. And when one of us has been tired, the other one has kind of flied the flag and kept the project going. So I think we work really, really well together. And I don't think either of us would like this project to end. And I think that we're doing work that is important for frontline workers, but also beyond the pandemic context. And I think as long as that's the case, we'll keep working together.
Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
You have been listening to Dr. Elaine Kinsella, University of Limerick, winner of the President's Research Excellence and Impact Early Career Researcher Awards 2022, and Dr. Rachel Sumner, Cardiff Metropolitan University.